Today's episode comes not from Silicon Valley, but from Cameroon. Population, 27 million. The capital, Yaounde. The currency, the CFA franc. Top exports, oil, lumber, aluminum, cocoa, coffee, and cotton. State languages, French and English. It was 1994. Nelly Diop was a little girl living in Douala, Cameroon, when all of a sudden, at the drop of a dime, France devalued the CFA franc, the currency used by more than a dozen of its former African colonies. So what'd that mean? Well, in countries like Gabon, Chad, Senegal, Ivory Coast, Cameroon, and many others, just like that, overnight, millions and millions of people lost half their purchasing power, half their wealth. Gone. Into thin air, with absolutely no say in the matter. And for Nelly, coming from a middle-class Cameroonian family, that day, well...
And I think it was the first time in my life I saw my dad crying.
Now, fast forward about 20 years from that day in 1994, and Nelly, while living in Europe, in her words, she met Bitcoin. And with eyes wide open, Nelly went through white papers, she went through exchanges, and became a very early adopter of the likes of Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Tezos. But she bought these assets not to make a quick buck, but because the assets were hers. Not at the control of a central bank, or even another country far, far away. And Nelly's enthusiasm for crypto? Well, by hosting meetups and crypto events in Cameroon, her passion for blockchain technology became so contagious that in 2020, Ijara was born. The first ever crypto exchange and non-custodial wallet built for Francophone Africa. And just over a year later, Ijara has over 10,000 users. And with a seed raise of $2 million a month ago, Nelly Diop just raised more money than any other female founder in Francophone African history. But the future for Nelly, the future for Ijara, it's not just about giving Francophone Africans easy access to the likes of SHIB and Doge. No, it's about improving the continent's financial literacy and striving for financial inclusion. I'm David Zabinski.
And I am Nelly Diop.
And this is not from Silicon Valley. Stories of trial and triumph from founders in emerging and frontier economies. Nelly, bonjour, and welcome to the show. So I know just based on our previous chats, this is going to be an incredibly fun and inspiring episode. So let's get started. And as you know, we always start with the following. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
So I was born and raised in Douala, which is the economic capital of Cameroon. But originally both of my parents come from the mountains in Cameroon. And it's also the region where like my tribe is called Bamileke. And Bamileke are the people that are really businessmen, are into like commerce, finance. So, you know, like your roots kind of define a little bit what you do, in the later stage. Yes.
Yeah. So you mentioned Douala as this economic capital of Cameroon, different from the actual capital, Yaounde. So talk a bit about that, Nelly. What's going on in Douala? What makes it this economic capital?
So I think it's mostly the economic capital because of we have like a port where you have a lot of boats coming in and out. So basically it's like the major hubs for offloading goods that's coming from containers for the central region, because even the people in Chad or in Gabon, you know, they take their goods from Douala ports. What else, like people in Douala, because, you know, when you are in the capital of Cameroon, Yaounde, there are a lot of public servants because all the ministers, everything are there.
Right.
So maybe people like aspire to become public servants and are less entrepreneurs. In Douala, you will see like a barrier cities, like everybody's always doing something. Like even for the few people that have like a stable job, they are they always have another source of revenue. So you will always see them like trying to sell you something else. Or even you will go to like a regular company and meet like the secretary, and then you start talking because maybe you have a meeting with her boss or her colleague, and then she tells you, By the way, madam, I'm selling shoes. I mean, I have really nice shoes for you, you know? So you're like, what the heck? Yeah, lots of entrepreneurs. Yeah.
All right. So people are grinding. People are hustling in Douala.
Yes. It's mostly hustling. Yeah.
Now, Nelly, you mentioned earlier that you're also from a tribe that's always been pretty business focused. Can you talk a bit about that tribe dynamic in Cameroon?
No, yeah, sure. So you have what we call almost 300 tribes and different languages in Cameroon. Those tribes are divided into like six large groups. And mine is, as I mentioned, like the west of Cameroon, which is the mountainous regions. And they were quite involved in against the fight, through colonization and everything. So we paid a huge toll because when, like France and, you know, and the first kind of regimes in Cameroon, they really did the massacre on our tribe, but we managed to still survive, and then we have been involved. So I think that's also explain why we stayed away from politics and everything, and we decided like to focus our efforts on, you know, like commerce, like finance, like developing our skills. So yeah.
And is this tribe dynamic still a big part of the Cameroonian social fabric?
I remember when I was a little girl, basically people were always reminded me that I was part of that tribe, you know. And I felt like it was very divided that way. But since I came back like 1 year ago, and even through my coming back and forth on vacation, I started noticing that this even notion of tribe is kind of dwindling. Like obviously people still keep their traditions that they inherited from their ascendants, but they identify more as Cameroonians. And you see it even through marriages. Like it used to be that people would only marry people from the same village. So I'm not even talking about tribe, because I told you like 6-7 large tribes, and within each tribe you have like 300 villages. So people will still like even marrying only people from their village. And now it's has completely disappeared, you know. But government-wise and at the state level, some people are trying to play the tribe, you know, the tribe to kind of divide for political gains. And this is really hurtful, because you will see that there is a push from the bottom to like, hey, well, we are Cameroonians. We aspire to kind of embrace all our differences and leverage that to build our nation for a better future. And some isolated individuals are trying to play like the tribe. Oh, don't look at Bamileke. They confiscated all the wealth. They are only trying to keep the wealth within their tribe. Oh, don't look at X. Don't look at Y. But I guess, you know, it's the same that's happening all around the world. Because if I look at France, my other kind of nation, you will see that they are always playing, oh, look at immigrants. They are stealing money from you, real French people. Although the elites, it's kind of stealing money, not the immigrants, because you are dead poor. How can you steal money you don't even have? And so it's get the focus elsewhere, you know, and try to design a scapegoat. But it's happening everywhere, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, everywhere indeed. People will label others only when it's convenient for them.
Yeah, definitely.
Nelly, you spoke a bit earlier about the colonial times when Cameroon was a French colony. So now in the grand scheme of things, Cameroon's been independent only pretty recently, right?
1960. Yeah, 1960.
Young.
Very young, yeah.
You know, I so vividly remember taking a U.S. history class in high school, and my teacher compared the U.S. to a teenager, right? Like, the U.S. is this wild, crazy adolescent that just doesn't know itself yet when you compare it to the other, I guess, more adult countries in Europe and the Far East. So if the U.S. was, let's say, born in 1776, what does that make Cameroon, born in 1960, right? A baby.
Yeah, Cameroon is a baby. And that's why sometimes people are comparing our day one with like the day 6,000 or 1 million of others.
Yeah, sorry, Nelly, I just want to cut you off right there. I mean, that's bullshit, right? To make that comparison. I mean, so much of sub-Saharan Africa was colonized ruthlessly by European countries only until so recently. You know, a lot of folks in the West, and they criticize how undeveloped some African countries are relative to the West, they fail to remember that these countries weren't ever really able to develop as these colonies were torn by the West, right?
So Cameroon is a funny anomaly in that region because we were colonized by like even three countries. So until World War I, we were colonized by Germany. And that's also why my great-grandmother spoke German, and my grandmother has like some German words, like even some German words made their way into our tribal languages.
Yeah, I had no idea.
And then after World War I, like one-fifth of the country was given to the UK and the other part to France. So as a consequence, we have two national languages, French and English. But the majority of the people speak French, but the two national languages are French and English.
And you went to French schools growing up, I take it?
Yes, I did.
And how about your family growing up, Nelly? Talk to me a bit about them.
So I grew up as the eldest of five sisters. We are only girls, but the pride of my dad, I mean, he kept reminding us. I mean, especially if you come back to that, you have to remember that the society being so young, like the place of girls and women are really kind of critical.
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
So I mean that when I was little, like having only daughters was seen as kind of a failure. So people, especially my dad, he's coming from like the king of our village. So he was encouraged to have a second wife because polygamy is also authorized so that he could have boys. Because only having daughters, what do you make with daughters, you know? And my dad was like, you know, my daughters are my pride and joy. You know, they are like the sweetest thing that happened to me. And I don't see the need to have like a boy, you know. The girls can do as much as boys. And I think it was pretty forward looking.
Yeah.
My dad was, and I realized that even now, like even at that time, I noticed that my dad was different from other dads. But now I realize even more because even comparing my dad to some people of my generation, he's still so open, so feminist, you know, and so this is kind of funny. So I grew up in Cameroon attending local schools and in the suburbs of Douala and having like extensive discussions on the way to school with my dad about philosophy, about history, about everything that you could imagine like a young kid wants to talk about the world, you know.
Okay, and how about university? What did you do after high school in Douala?
So after my high school diploma, I went to France because, you know, I've always loved mathematics, physics, like those were my preferred subject matters. So I went to France to become an engineer in computer science. I did that, and in the course of my study, I had like 1 year work experience in the US, and that's when I kind of embraced also the culture. And I started dreaming in English, and that's so funny because, you know, I feel like in the way I sometimes react, I have like the French culture, I have my Cameroonian culture, but I also have, you know, the American ones.
You know, as an American myself, I got to ask this. What is it that you see or what types of principles do you define as American culture?
Yeah, so this notion like, you know, like time is money and that, you know, it's being entrepreneur is that kind of feel natural state, you know. You should always kind of aspire to like being like, financial freedom. Financial freedom is a notion that is typically American, to be honest. Like, I think other cultures are taking it now, but it's not so much like in the French, like in French culture, you know, you have a work, you go to work, you have like your 2 hours lunch, you have your weekends, your vacations, you enjoy your family, you balance everything. In America, I learned that balancing everything meant prioritizing something at some point and then the other thing at other time. And then in France, balancing is like, I allocate 50% to my personal life, 50% to my work life. And, you know, that's maybe, exaggerating it, but that's how I feel it, you know, and that's how I perceive it. So this is like the part of like American culture that I embrace.
All right. So you adopt some of this American entrepreneurial work focused ethos, I suppose. You get your university degree. What'd you do next?
And then I returned back to France, and then I start my career, in France as an engineer in computer science, like a software developer. I do that for like 3 years, but then, you know, I'm the kind of person that wants to take decisions, that wants to be part of to be in the room where decisions are taken. And I was like software developers, and I will see those crazy projects coming in. I was like, who are the people deciding on those projects? I need to be in that room to tell them it's bullshit. And because in France, like once you do a certain type of study, you are kind of close to that specialty. So in order to change my career course, I needed to do an MBA. And I did that in France at HEC and London Business School.
Yeah, I want to stop you there. It's so funny you say that. I went to a liberal arts college in the U.S. and with liberal arts degrees. I did political science and Spanish. And then I moved to Dubai, and a lot of my European friends immediately said, oh, okay, so you want to be a Spanish-speaking politician? Like, as if my college major was the only determining factor of my career. It's a shame that it's that rigid in most parts of the world.
Yes, definitely. Like, in France, if you are a computer science a major, you have graduated, you're going to spend your whole life being computer science. And even when people ask you, where do you see yourself in like 10, 20 years? You have to say, as a CTO of a company. I mean, shit, like I'm diverse, you know, as I mentioned, and I'm always the one embracing like diversity. Like I have the American culture, the French culture, the African. Why do you want me to stick to computer science? I want to do everything. So, and I was also surprised because when I was in London Business School and I did some months in investment banking, I was so surprised because all the French people were either graduates in finance or MBAs like me that did it to switch careers. But the people from the UK or elsewhere in the US or in Australia were at like they had philosophy as a major. Like, you did philosophy at university and now you're doing investment banking and you are even better than I. So it doesn't really matter at the end of the day.
Exactly. All right. So let's get back to you. Nelly, you got your MBA and that was what, 2007?
Oh, it was 2007, 2008. Yes.
Okay. And from there you went into banking?
Yes. So in 2007, like after like LBS, I went to Credit Suisse in 2007.
Whoa. So you start at Credit Suisse right before the GFC?
Yes, I know. You see, you kind of see the dots aligning. Yes, exactly. So I was an associate in the leverage buyout team in Credit Suisse. And, you know, I was enjoying it. And then shit started hitting the fans. And I was like, what is happening? And the crazy things were, the managing director was saying, there is a lot of liquidity on the market. It's only a trust issue. Only a trust issue? So look at the term. There's liquidity is only a trust issue. A trust issue. Come on. You are priming me for blockchain technology. Don't say that. And also, you know, during the course of my experience there, I started noticing that when you hold like strong values, like I do, sometimes like doing stuff that are kind of counter, that really violates your values, it really feels like sometimes like you are transforming yourself. So at some point when I was pitching during the due diligence, like making the arrangements with the real story, that the real books of the company and everything, I was asking myself like, oh, I don't like the person I'm gonna become if I stay in that business for 3 years. Because my aim was always like, okay, go into the business, stay 3-4 years, amass a lot of money, then you can do some good. And then I was like, after 6 months, no, I don't really like that the person I'm gonna become. And then the subprime happened. So, I mean, there wasn't even that many jobs left, to be honest. So that's when I came back to France and I changed kind of career again.
So what was next?
So next was I joined this company called Revenue Management Solutions, specialized in pricing and monetization and working with the foods industry, like the McDonald's, like Quick and all the like fast food and restaurant chains. So basically it was combining like marketing strategy, like quantitative skills, because a lot of statistical modeling and data modeling to determine the right price for the right item at the right location.
All right. And how long did you do that for?
So, and then I do that for 3 years. And I'm still a consultant, right? So I'm mainly kind of advising like executive committees, like CEOs, like what should be their approach to pricing, like what prices I'm recommending for what menus, what items. And after 3 years, I feel like, oh, there's also a big discovery about myself. I love to kind of bear the consequences of my decisions. And when I'm a consultant, I feel like whenever I advise something and it works well, I can say, oh, it's thanks to my advice. But whenever it doesn't work well, I can say, you operationally mis-executed what I recommended. I feel like this is bullshit, right? You know, I want, because how do I learn? How do I progress if it's always somebody else's fault when things are going bad? And if it's always my kind of genius, if everything goes well, I don't like that. I don't like that feeling.
You know, Nelly, it's so funny you say that. Our last guest was Ismail Belkhayat from Morocco, and he's formerly BCG, right? And he just went on to raise the biggest seed round in Moroccan history. Nelly, he said the same thing, that whilst consulting helps you develop this really strong skill set, it can be really, really unrewarding.
Exactly. So the next move was join like a more operational role, and it was possible at one of the biggest retail grocery stores in France, Casino Group. So I joined there as a pricing director. And basically, it was setting up the department. So a lot of things I love about it. Like first, it was an operational role. Second, I was an entrepreneur because the function, the department didn't exist. I was kind of higher one, you know, higher number one. And then you now have to grow it the way you like. And the third thing was, you know, I moved from pricing like burgers, I think like mostly 300 items on the menu, to like 80,000 items, like all foods and some non-foods. So already like only the scaling part is already more challenging when it comes to like the statistical part of it or the data analysis part of it. And I also managed to put pricing into the executive committee. And I was still very young. So imagine me like enter the executive committee at like 27 or 28. Kind of a black female woman, like, you know, and everyone else is like 50 plus. They are white guys, and still, you know, I cannot shut up, you know, because whenever I have an idea, I always talk and push forward.
Right. You know, I've been thinking this whole time, Nelly, you've worked in a white male dominated industry for so many years. As an African woman, my God, you must have some stories.
Oh, my goodness. Like, one that still stuck to my mind at Credit Suisse was, like, me arranging, like, this whole deal, like, this high-debt syndication with this company in Poland, like, booking, like, with the PR, everything, like, the nice hotel, bring the investors, like, preparing everything. And then the final day come, that all the investors have prepped the CFO, the CEOs, and as investors start coming, And they look at me, and I was with my MD. They start telling me, oh, can you fetch us some coffee? And I need some sugar. And like, and you know, I'm like so puzzled. And I'm like, I've been talking to those people like 1 month because I'm the one that have been answering their questions and everything for emails, for phone. And now they're seeing me, they're just assuming that I'm the coffee person or whatsoever. And my MD, who was like an Indian guy, was like, telling them, no, she's your investment bank. She's the one that organized all this. She's the one that's going to do the follow-up with you. And, you know, like this, I think this one sum up like everything else. And, but I always tend to, like, I think that I always tend to analyze those things with like more smiles than if I had grew up with that constant reminder of the fact that people perceive me different. I think that what makes my experience unique, even given those microaggressions and racism and all the thing, was the fact that I grew up in Cameroon with two loving parents that gave me like all the fortitude that helped me define who I was. My dad would always say, you could be the president of any country you decide. So I grew up with that mentality. I could do everything. My dad told me so. So if my dad cannot lie to me. So if my dad told me I could be the president of anything, what the heck? Who are you to tell me otherwise? Who are you? You know, so I would just smile saying, oh, this stupid person, like, look at what mistake you make. Do you really feel I will even answer your email like as quickly as did previously? And that I will brush it off and I will go on.
No, of course not. No, Nelly, it's incredible. I mean, facing that type of, well, bullshit, the relationship you shared with your father, it really prepared you for it.
Definitely. Definitely.
All right. So let's go back to your story. You've got this tremendous success for a few years, changing the pricing models for this French supermarket chain. What happened next?
So after that, because it was such a success at the first company, you know, I was headhunted to another one, still launching the pricing department, but this time with like a retail store with non-food items like electronic goods, appliances and everything. And it also had a part of e-commerce. So this was good because, you know, I moved from 300 goods to like 80,000 and now to like millions because basically you had to price the whole product on internet. So through that, I think it was at that moment that I both got more acquainted with artificial intelligence and 1 year later blockchain. And I also started, and that's when I also met blockchain and Bitcoin.
Sorry, you said that's when you met Bitcoin?
I say met and I choose, and the word is not because I'm a French speaker. It's really because for me, it's a person. For me, it's like the second like great meet of my life after my husband, because you know, I just fell my head down, like through and through. Like I was reading this post on Quora.
What's that?
Quora. Quora, like Q-U-O-R-A.
Ah, Quora, of course.
Quora, yes, Quora. And it was about...
Sorry, so when was this?
It was in 2015. So I see this post on like blockchain and I see like the things mentioned like liquidity, trust. I'm like, liquidity, trust. This reminds me of something. And then I see like the use case that was highlighted was remittances. And you know, what I didn't tell prior is that I came to France at 17 and from day one, I felt the urge to send back money home like every single month, because if not for my close family, you always have friends in need, like extended family and everything. And basically every time I will send like $100 worth, I will pay like $15, and those $15 were my allowance for a week for food. So like every single time I will send money back, I would just basically say, oh, my weekly allowance for food, I'm sending it to fees. Hopefully this company is doing things that are more useful with that money that I could do, you know.
15%? That's ridiculous.
Yes, it was Western Union at that time. Exactly. No, exactly.
Is the cost still that high today, by the way? I mean, for those in the African diaspora to send money home?
Fortunately, it has, the cost has dwindled, I think, to like between 8 and 12%, which is still a lot. But at that time, it was really 15%. They were like the monopoly. So what could you do, right?
Right.
So when I read about this post and remittance, and then after that, I read the white paper, and it was so beautiful. I could see like pattern. It spoke to me. It spoke to me in ways like few things have spoke to me. And I was like, oh my goodness, I will dedicate the rest of my life to talk about this, to know more about this, to like do everything I can about this space. And first I started like by, I think I bought like my first Bitcoin, Ether, and then XRP there at that moment. Because for me, when I bought it, I didn't even feel the price would go up. I just felt like I'm investing in the future I want to happen. Even if this money, I lose it, it's okay. And to be honest, I didn't put a small amount. I really put like, look at how angry I was. Like I put like, basically like, I think it was my 1 month or 2 months worth of wages, like there on the spot. I didn't really understand a lot of this. I was just, you know, rooting for this kind of blockchain technology to spread in the world.
So buying these cryptos, Nelly, you weren't gambling or even trading. It was almost your way of saying to the system that you became to know so well, like, fuck you.
Yes, exactly. Fuck you. Exactly. For me, it was that. For me, it was that. And then I think 6 months into that, I look at the portfolio. I was like, what is happening? Because I had like 10x already. I'm like, what is happening with this shit? Because it's not supposed to increase in time. It's supposed to be this beautiful technology that we develop application to do remit and everything. And that's when I kind of dove deep a little bit further, because I started even like mining, programming. I did like everything I could do, learning about other kind of blockchain protocols and everything.
All right. So this is back in 2015 or so. What platform were you using?
So yes, the first platform I found like with lots of trouble. And even to set up my account, it was lots of trouble. It was Bitstamp. So I started with Bitstamp. And I think going from there, I had like 15 platforms, because every time I had this coin I wanted to buy that was only available on this coin. So I would create my, it started like, I think since that day, I've never spent like a full hour without mentioning Bitcoin or blockchain or something, or like everything could be like a smart contract. Everything could be like on blockchain technology. I want to put everything there. Like for me, it's just the pathway to a fairer world. And one thing I didn't mention growing up, and I also, when I look that post, that also reminded me of it, is in 1994, France decided to devalue the CFA franc. So the local currency used across 15 countries in Central and Africa region. So basically, it was debasement of the money, right? Devaluation, your money is worth 50% the day after. And I think it was the first time in my life I saw my dad crying. I think by now, you know that I love my dad. And I think this was like one of the biggest trauma of my childhood, because my dad is not supposed to cry. I mean, and then I was like, how can you do? Because we were middle class. So I know my parents are, they spend, they save, you know. And I'm like, how can you do everything the right way? How can you even manage to be part of the middle class, which is already difficult at that moment, to save some money, and then you are still exposed to exogenous factors. You cannot preserve your wealth. So when I look at blockchain, I also look at a way to control, to protect your wealth. And that's also the notion of ownership, of having the sole control properties on your asset. It's really dear to me.
Yeah, on that topic, I mean, so many folks are seeing the monetary policies of these European countries, the nonstop cash printing by the Fed in the US, that you know, these are naturally catalysts for crypto adoption. But for you, seeing your parents lose half their wealth due to central bank policy, not even your own countries, it was personal. Can you just give me a quick history lesson on that?
Yeah, so, you know, it happens that after the decolonization, the CFA franc was pegged to the French francs. And it's still the case now. Like now it's back to euros.
Still? By all the former colonies?
Yes, it's like the same currency used in all those countries that were colonized by France. And the fact is France, like being pegged to like this foreign currency allows us to have supposedly like stability when it comes, like we have not like a huge inflation like in Zimbabwe or Nigeria or Ghana. It's
right. So no 100 trillion CFA franc notes like we saw in Zimbabwe.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then it also comes with strings attached, you know, because you have to keep like a whole bunch of your reserve currency, like in foreign currency in France coffers, like in the treasury. France, they can dispose it of it the way they want. I mean, obviously, they claim an IOU. In the central banks on the ground, you have French representatives. They used to have the veto. I'm not so sure about now. I think they still do. So every decision that you take in your central bank, they have a veto. And it's a foreign country. So guess what? Do you think like really they are rooting for you to succeed or for them to like preserve their kind of control? So, yeah, I know that people are talking about inflation when it comes to Nigeria and Ghana, but to be honest, you know, they're not faring that bad in my book.
So for you, with your personal experience, Nelly, it's pretty refreshing to hear that your foray into crypto wasn't just about making a quick buck.
No. Because since for me, it was never about like making money. It just made me like kind of more like curious about what was happening, what was the underlying like, you know, reason. And that's when I started like exploring, like listening to all the podcasts, like buying books, like experimenting myself, like learning the difference between the shit coins and the real coin. And starting organizing, participating into meetups, like Bitcoin meetups in France and elsewhere, attending conferences and webinars. Yeah.
So what happened next?
So what happened next? Then I changed job again. I changed jobs again. And we decided to move from Paris to the city of Bordeaux with my new job. Because now, after doing pricing for so long, I felt the need to like really embrace more of my other passion, artificial intelligence. So I became chief data officer at the gambling company, one of the leading European countries. So it was also the same building from the ground up, you know. So it's kind of my thing now. So I joined this company after my second born, so in 2017. And like I stay 3 years until I resign, and I build like the department from like myself to like 35 people, embracing all different data career spectrum, from data engineer, data scientist, to data analyst and machine learning engineers. And in the process of that, I also started organizing meetups in Africa. So 2018, I participated in the first kind of blockchain conference in Cameroon. I was part of the panel, and I think my understanding was getting better and better, because at the end, a lot of people were coming to me saying, what is your company again? We want you to manage our portfolio. We want you to organize like a blockchain group for women. We want you. And people were selling me with all those wants. And I was like, oh, so do they feel that I am expert enough to do it? And I realized that, I might be, you know, like, when you are one-eyed in a city of like blind people, you are still the expert, you know. So I wouldn't say like I'm an expert, like full stop, but compared to them and like the nascent industry everywhere, I was. So I started thinking about what could I do in that space in Africa.
So as this expert, Nelly, I imagine you'd amass quite a few followers or consumers of a crypto-related product or service in Africa. What you do?
In 2020, I felt like, okay, now I have this solid idea that I feel passionate enough to leave everything behind and to concentrate on it. And this was Ijara, like building like this non-custodial wallet at the base layer and adding on ramp and off ramp fiat so that people in different countries in Africa could set.
Okay, but before we dive deeper, let's just get a quick glossary of sorts of some blockchain and crypto terms. So first, you mentioned non-custodial wallet.
Sure. So non-custodial wallet means, and it goes to the saying, not your keys, not your coins. So it means that when you download your Ijaha app on your phone, one thing that you are provided with are your 12 words mnemonic. Those 12 words are basically your private key to kind of access your tokens on the blockchain. And it goes to my strong understanding and willingness that people should own their own property and nobody should be able to seize it.
All right. So a non-custodial wallet, you have access to what's inside. No one else. Not an exchange, not a bank. No one.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. And off-ramp, on-ramp?
Off-ramp, on-ramp. Then you set it up and people say, oh, great. Now I have a great way to store my asset. How do I buy some? And then you look at all the exchanges. All the prices are in dollars, in euros, in pounds. Where is the CFA franc? Nowhere to be found. So Nelly has to do it. Basically, so that's when I started plugging in Cameroon, in Ivory Coast, Senegal, Gabon, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, using what they know, mobile money. So this is another term. This is like the payment system that is well used across Africa, mobile money.
Right. So you're providing a ramp for users to exchange easily between CFA franc and cryptos. And now you're also allowing customers to onboard using mobile money, which is...
So, you know, in Africa, even now, like 90% of the transaction, at least in the part of Africa I'm operating, sub-Saharan Africa, 80 to 90% of transactions are still in cash.
Wow.
What people have started doing, and it started with M-Pesa in Kenya in 2007, allowing people to hold their money on their phone. So basically, you will go to a local agent that works for the telecom company because mobile money wallets originated with telecom companies. So you go to an agent, you give your 10,000 CFA franc and uploads it to your mobile money wallet, and then you can transfer it to somebody else. You can buy phone credit with that. You can pay your bills. So that's how mobile money operates.
Yeah, you know, I spend a lot of time in sub-Saharan Africa, and I see folks at these MTN, these Airtel stands, in line to give cash to these telecom providers to be able to then transfer it digitally throughout the country, which naturally has a fee.
Naturally, as a fee, and now it's kind of expensive sometimes because, especially when they have the monopoly, it could be expensive anywhere from 1 to 3%. But it's huge to make like intra-country transfers. I mean, look, in Europe, like the SEPA transfer is like free. You can wire transfer like your money everywhere for zero. But yeah, so here it's not. So the on-ramp and off-ramp. In Ijaha, how does it work? Basically, you go to your Ijaha app and you say like, okay, I want to buy like X amount of Bitcoin. And then I tell you, oh, this is how much you have to pay me to buy that because to get delivered that. And then you pay with your mobile money because we connect the APIs and then you receive the money and you receive your tokens.
So as an Ijaha user, I can upload my CAF franc for crypto using mobile money.
Yes, mobile money and credit card. But mobile money is what 95% of them use because it's much more practical. To have a credit card, usually you need to have a bank account. But 12% of people own a bank account. And I even think that those 12% are overrated because they are counting people many times. Like if you have 5 bank accounts, they are counting you 5 times. So I don't think it's 12%.
So, you know, to me, it's astounding. You're operating in a fintech space, but fewer than 10% of your customers, Nelly, have bank accounts?
Yes, I would say that, yeah.
So aside from just letting folks, hopefully, see a return on their wealth, by using Ijaha, you're also playing a big part in African financial inclusion.
No, yeah, definitely. 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 And that's why I feel like, you know, mobile money already added a good step forward into the financial inclusion area. But we are adding another layers because financial inclusion for me should be linked to financial freedom at some point. Like, how do I invest? How do I manage to take some credits? And when I see the DeFi potential, decentralized finance potential, and the blockchain, like you can invest your money into asset, the asset value could grow, but you can also stake those and earn interest and then you can also borrow some money at affordable rates, because when you go to a lending space platform and you borrow some money, they don't know if you are a black woman in a village in Senegal, or you are a white guy, a farmer in Arizona, or a big shot in Wall Street. Maybe the differentiator will be the amount of money you want to borrow. But, you know, your interest rate is not like discriminated.
Yeah. So personal loans, microfinance, why is that so important in Africa, Nelly?
You have to bear in mind that microfinance here, that's more affordable, less procedural than banks. They give out loans at 20% interest rate a year.
20%?
So I'm like, what kind of business do you do if it's not like drugs or anything else to be able to bear like 20% interest rate? I understand they are a business. I'm telling you, I understand it's a business. I understand like maybe the assessment of the risk is high, but let's be honest here. When you give a farmer an interest rate of 20%, how do you expect him to be successful in the long run? I don't believe it.
I don't believe it either. It's by no means a way to catalyze economic growth. And, you know, on these topics, Nelly, of these lenders, the banks, the regulators, how do they see your platform? Competition?
So this premise that I think the central banks and the authorities really want financial inclusion to happen, because like operating a cash-based system is not efficient, especially in those times and ages. But I'm not so sure banks are interested in those folks, because first they feel like they don't have enough money, you know, because at Ijara you can start investing as low as like 5,000 CFA francs, which is less than $8. So it doesn't, for a bank, I mean, it doesn't really make sense to have this kind of people. The second thing is the informal market is still large. So the way the bank structure works, like how do you access an informal gig operator? Like his income is not regular. Like what can you propose him? Like it's too much work for like maybe too much hassle for maybe not really a large benefit. So basically, Ijara is still very young, so the banks don't really see us as competitors. They have a lot of competition to do with the telcos companies, so for now, they're not even looking at us. But the regulators have been like, I've observed the playbook of Brian Armstrong with Coinbase, and I felt like I wanted to do more like that than doing like the CZ approach with Binance. So from day one, I started talking to the regulators, to the people in the Ministry of Finance, to the people in the central banks, trying to explain what I was doing. And since I started like as a non-custodial wallet, they didn't really see like the systemic risk I would pose to the region, you know, like to this financial, because even if I lose money, I lose my money, I don't lose like people's money. So that really helps a lot, at least to engage the conversation. And in the process of that, I started like acquiring some licenses. Like as of now, I have an investor advisory license in the Central Africa zone. So that also allows us, because you are identified as kind of a regulated body, to be on board in the discussion around like laying out the foundation for a future crypto regulation, which will happen, because 2 weeks ago there was this large conference among the regulated bodies and public and central bankers, and also the financial market regulators, and they explained that they didn't want to forbid it because they felt that it was anyway too late. You know, people are already embracing it. And also thanks to what I've been telling them, that you have all those people trading like Bitcoin, Ethereum, all the crypto on WhatsApp groups, Telegram groups, Facebooks for millions of dollars every day. So if your mission is to protect the consumers, please do regulate so that consumers can differentiate between legit entities and the others that are only scammers. So this also helps the conversation.
Do you just say people are trading millions of dollars in crypto on WhatsApp?
I'm telling you, that's what they are doing, and millions of dollars. Basically, you can have people buying like $1 million worth of Bitcoin through a person that is part of the same WhatsApp group they are in. Imagine all the risk involved, all the scams happening in that area.
All right. So I could see how your platform would be welcomed with open arms by governments, by regulators. So let's get technical. How are you stocking your crypto inventory of sorts for your users to buy?
So it's like a rolling inventory, right? So because I also have to hedge for against the volatility of those tokens. So that's where this business is kind of more difficult to operate in our part of the world than elsewhere. Because look at, and I invite you to look at all the FX brokers, you know, you will rarely see CFA listed as a really, you know, regular currency they could exchange through dollars or euros. And then you don't also have a liquidity market that is huge enough to have Bitcoin price in CFA, for example. So we use subterfuge. We use like a lot of different ways to like replenish our inventory. And then one could be that some people are selling, others are buying. So this is one way to like have the two legs. Other ways are like when some people have like businesses in Africa and they want to have access to CFA fund, they could send us their USDC, USDT, because we are not regulated yet in Europe or in the US to receive directly fiat currencies. So we receive USDT or USDC, and then we give them CFA francs, and that's also help us to replenish our inventory. So those are kind of two ways that, and every single day we have brainstorming, like every week, brainstorming session to diversify our ways to, you know, increase the working capital inventory. And that's also why we raised that sit round, because at some point the demand was overflowing us and we were lacking on the supply, and we were like, this is a shit problem to have, because you can sell whatever you have, but you don't have enough to sell. So what can we do?
Aha, right. That seed round, the one heard all around the world. I've got two headlines opened up in some tabs in front of me. Just one second. All right. So this was TechCrunch. Cameroon's Ijara raises $2 million to offer crypto and investment services in Francophone Africa. This one is Bitcoin News. Startup raises $2 million to pioneer cryptocurrency usage in Francophone Africa. And Nelly, this was all just like a month ago. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Apparently, I'm the female entrepreneur that raised the most in Francophone Africa. And this was kind of news to me. I was like, what's happened? Like, you know, it's not possible. But yeah.
Unreal. So let's talk about the raise. $2 million. What valuation?
So I raised $2 million. If I tell you the valuation, my co-founder and my investor will kill you now, right now, and will kill us both. So maybe at the Serie A, I will be able to announce the valuation. But it was a nice one because, I mean, I have fantastic investors. They didn't try to take the upper hand or use like some kind of bargaining power to twist my hands. So I have a fair valuation. I think I raised as though I was a startup company in Europe at this stage.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about your cap table, the ones I don't want to get killed by. You raised from US VCs, European, African, family offices.
I told you I embraced my diverse personality. So the lead investors were conscious with Meltem Demirhaus that I've been admiring since like 3-4 years. I think she was my Keanu Reeves of when I was 15. You know, when I was 15, Keanu Reeves was like, the person I really love in this world. And then Meltem Demirhaus, when I started my journey in crypto, she became the one I fancied the most. So for me, it felt so good that she will be the one leading this store. And then Antemis, which is the largest VC fintech in Europe. So both US and European.
All right. And what's the capital used for? App development, marketing, expanding into other markets?
Oh my god, like we roll out like the first look, new look of our app like 1 week ago, and customers have been crazy about it. And I think this also part of the money we raised. We wanted to hire more talents to like do like a better product, a better design, and also to start investing into growth. Because so far we have reached 10,000 users like 3 days ago, and we did that through word of mouth.
Ah, congrats.
Thank you. So through word of mouth, you know, so it starts with, we need to start investing consistently into growth and marketing to even accelerate this user base you have, because the more customers, the more features we can unlock, and the more community, the larger the community we can gather around this specific features that will solve their financial needs.
Okay. And the cryptos one could purchase now on Ajara. Got Bitcoin?
Yes.
Okay. Ethereum?
Ethereum, yes.
And Tezos?
Tezos. And they can also stake. They can also stake their Tezos and earn some interest rates on a yearly basis. So they have like a saving wallet, an investment wallet. You see, like we started getting there.
No, it's great. And of the 10,000 users, Nelly, most come from Cameroon?
Cameroon, like half of it, and then the rest, Ivory Coast, Senegal, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Gabon. And 1% of those come from the diaspora, because we also have this partnership with MoonPay that allows us to have to sell in euro, dollars, and pounds, and yes, to the diaspora. Because I always saw Ajara as being this inclusive platform where you have African of all sorts living in the continent, even within the continent, living in big cities, in small cities, in villages, and living outside the continents coming together. Because if you think about decentralized finance and lending and borrowing, who's going to be providing the liquidity? I want this community to also think forward about empowering themselves to grow their economies, to invest in their community, in their motherlands, and then maybe reach like our financial freedom as a world continent.
All right. Is it fair to say that you effectively want to be the Coinbase of Africa?
I never put it that way. That's how Jason put it. But for me, it's mostly about like what kind of impact I will make. I really want people to remember that at some point when something is said about like how Francophone Africa evolved from this overlooked region to where it is now, this successful region, that Ajara is named as one of the things that was, you know, at the birth of it. What main characteristic is that when I speak about crypto, I speak about utility always. That's the conversation I have with my customers. And I always try to educate financially. So I created even a YouTube channel where I do like 5 minute videos explaining like in plain words, what is a smart contract? What is blockchain? What are the careers involved? What are the differences between cryptocurrencies? And I have to say that I have 40% of women in Ajara investing in crypto. This is unheard of. Look at all the other platforms, like even the likes of Coinbase. I'm not so sure they can boast more than 15% or 20% if they are really good. 40%. Why is that? Because we are not activating the adrenaline part of, you know, the like the brain, like the casino, the gambling part. This is not what we are in it. I talk to women about like, this is also how you save to prepare for your retirement funds. This is how you can save a portion of it to finance your kids' studies. This is how you save even to realize, like, to buy a piece of land or a piece of real estate further down the road. Look at the historical prices. Look at the potential. Look at what are the features that are coming in. And also, this could also be part of you that are in the informal sector to start having a digital footprint that you can use tomorrow to tell the banks, to tell the microfinance, look, I'm at a less service because I already own some asset that you could use as collateral to give me like a fair rate on my credit, you know. And that's also why we are activating, looking for partnership with microfinance. We are currently negotiating this partnership with microfinance because they're interested in using like people that have assets as a collateral to give them loans, you know, and at a better rate. So this is the kind of thing I want to see happen.
Yeah. So back to the social impact component, you've mentioned the importance of two things. So the first, Ijara being a non-custodial wallet in that users, they own their assets. And two, that 40% of your users are women. Can you talk a bit about that dynamic?
Oh, my goodness. You see, in many parts of Africa, women are still considered as properties. So, like, when you are considered as a property, the notion of owning a property is something that is so foreign to your mind that when someone explains to you how, like, it is and how it's possible, you just have this aha moment. And I think that's why I've seen like the rush of them on my platform, because for some of them, for the first time, they are able to say, I own something that I have full control. It's not my husband. It's not my brother. It's not my dad. You know, it's me, myself. And because even for those that are financially independent and that save through their bank accounts and everything, somehow the husband can have access, you know, like through coercion or anything to your bank account. So, and sometimes they are even making alliances with like the bankers, and the bankers say, oh, he's your husband, so obviously I will give him access to your bank account. How come? Like, in what world?
In what world indeed? So to think that you've given, what, 4,000 women the opportunity to say, this is mine. This is mine. It's really inspiring, which I guess begs my next question. Nelly, when we talk a year from now, how many total users will Ijara have?
Oh, at a minimum 100,000 users. And I hope it's going to be even double that. I hope to bring more ways to people to not only protect their wealth, but to grow their wealth. So bringing in features that really solve a problem. I really hope that when we talk, David, 1 year from now, whenever I tell you, oh, we added this crypto, we added this feature, I can tell you why exactly I see that as a main differentiator in the life of people from my community. That's the way I want to approach Ijara.
Yeah, okay, so that's my next question, right? The goal of Ijara isn't just to let folks trade cryptos. It's to boost financial literacy, financial inclusion. I take it you'll eventually add other asset classes to the app? Public equities, ETFs?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Because when you talk about investing, diversification is like one of the key key player in the roadmap. So next year, we're going to be adding securities, local and U.S. securities. And we are also exploring the mutual funds, like bonds, especially like we want to present to our community like a large run coming from like less volatile to more volatile assets, so that you can start having like a diverse portfolio depending on your risk appetite of where you stand. Because if you talk about retirement when you are 50, I won't advise you to invest the same as if you were 20. So we also need to be mindful of that. And in the process, because we have a financial market that is nascent in that region, so I feel like people will learn the financial market for crypto.
Nelly, it seems you could very well boost financial inclusion, not just in Cameroon, but on the entire African continent, which seems like a great place to conclude the episode.
Oh, you're so nice. I'm not so sure it's going to be for the whole continent. It's so large, but I will do my part for, you know, for whatever community will welcome me. And David, you have been formidable, because I remember when we started this conversation, I was telling you about my fear of not speaking English enough. And then you reassured me. And this really felt like a conversation through and through. So thank you for that.
You know, Nelly, I've been thinking this whole time. We all know how bullish Jack Dorsey is on both crypto and on Africa. He's got to hear this episode. No?
Oh, especially since, you know, I applied to like this Bitcoin Trust membership, you know, like Jack Dorsey and Jay-Z are setting up for Africa and India. I managed to pass a few rounds. So I'm still up and running. So if he has it and if he feels inspired, fingers crossed.
That was Nelly Diop and Ijara, not from Silicon Valley, but from Douala, Cameroon. New episodes of the podcast are released every other week, so be sure to subscribe to, share, and rate review Not From Silicon Valley on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, and we'll see you soon.